is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
The word is not communicate, it's over-communicate. Why is it over-communicate? Because you're always going to get slippage. But if you tell them to communicate, when they slip, they're going to go to silent. So you tell them to over-communicate. And what does that mean, coach? That means, hey, I'm on your left, I'm on your right. I've got the ball stop. I've got the first pass. This has to be a part of every practice that you do every day.
Butch Carter is the founder of Analytics for Coaches and currently serves as the analytics coaching mentor to the NBA's assistant coaching program. He has been a trailblazer on basketball analytics ever since his record-breaking 1999-2000 season as the head coach of the Toronto Raptors. Analytics for Coaches is designed specifically to help coaches win more games. Butch was a standout athlete at Middletown High School, where he was named Ohio's 1976 High School Player of the Year. Carter was recruited by legendary college coach Bobby Knight of Indiana. He was named co-captain as a senior and led the team to the 1980 Big Ten Championship. He was the first guard to lead the Big Ten in field goal percentage at 54% and shot 51% for his career at Indiana. Butch was drafted by the Lakers in the second round and played a total of 6 years in the NBA with the Los Angeles Lakers, Indiana Pacers, New York Knicks, and Philadelphia 76ers. After his playing career, Butch returned to Middletown High School as the head varsity basketball coach, where in his second season he was named Ohio High School Coach of the Year. He is the only person to ever be named both player and coach of the year in the state of Ohio. Carter then served as a college assistant at Long Beach State with Joe Harrington and the University of Dayton with Jim O'Brien before jumping to the NBA, where he worked for 6 years as an assistant with the Milwaukee Bucks for Del Harris and Mike Dunleavy. He moved on to Toronto, where he was first an assistant and later became the head coach for the Raptors, coaching future Hall of Famers Vince Carter and Tracy McGrady. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. Believe it or not, those ratings help your friends and colleagues find the show. If you really love what you're hearing, please recommend the Hoopheads pod to someone and get them to join you as a part of Hoopheads Nation. Be prepared to take some notes and learn some coaching truths as you listen to this episode with Butch Carter, former NBA player, NBA coach, and the founder of Analytics for Coaches. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast longtime NBA player, NBA coach, Butch Carter from Middletown, Ohio. Butch, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad that you guys are allowing me a chance to be a part of your podcast.
Well, we're very pleased to have an opportunity to get to talk to someone who's had such success in the game at all levels, which we're going to get into and talk about. Let's start out by going back to your childhood growing up in Middletown, Ohio, and what got you into the game of basketball as a kid.
Well, I think, I didn't go to Middletown till my 10th grade year. I grew up in Troy, born in Springfield. And in Troy, we played everything. We played football, played basketball. I don't think I lost a game 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. I don't think I lost a game. And then we moved to Middletown, where originally my dad was from. And so I went there to play for legendary Paul Walker, one of the all-time winningest high school coaches in Ohio. And, you know, what got me into it was, you know, I was very competitive about wanting to get a scholarship. I don't think I could have went to school like Indy University without sports. I was all Ohio in football, but I was player of the year my senior year in basketball, and just preferred basketball over football. So it was a lot of work. I always took it very serious because of what I wanted to achieve. Never thought I'd play in the NBA or anything. I really just wanted to get a scholarship and be the first person in my family to graduate from college.
Why do you think you had that drive back then? What do you think? Was it something innate? Was it something that came from your parents, your surroundings? What do you think that was?
It was pretty much innate. I didn't have a father in the household. There were six kids. Pretty much, you know, been working most of my life since I was 14 years old. And I had a friend named Tom Price. We played 4th grade through 7th grade together in Troy, Ohio. And his dad owned the typewriter company, but Tom would let me over his house after practices, and I just saw how he lived. There was a woman there cleaning the house. I thought Tom's mother was the prettiest woman in the world, and it was just a clean environment, and it was an organized environment, and that's kind of how I wanted to live. I always lived in a clean household, but Tom just had more. He was a spoiled little brat. but it was a wonderful life experience for me. I could never repay him for allowing me into his home and just seeing how people who had established themselves financially could live.
So as you're growing up and you had that goal in mind of getting a scholarship, at what point did you start to feel like, hey, that's a reality and I'm going to get an opportunity to go and play college basketball? At what point did the recruiting process sort of get involved with you, and when did you think that, hey, I'm really going to have an opportunity to go and play beyond high school?
Well, in Middletown, we were very good. I think one year there were two guys on the first or second team All-State, and I was one of them. And those guys were being recruited, and we were all very close. And they kind of looked at me like as a little brother. So I got to see all the recruiting part, the home visits I sat in on. And you know, I had in my junior year, we that Middletown team, we were undefeated during the regular season. But the star player, the senior player, I was a junior, injured his ankle. And we went to play at Springfield South against Wayne Wiseman's team. And Springfield is where, again, I had a lot of family. And I dropped 42 points in a game at Springfield South. And it was pretty clear from there that I could manage any situation in a basketball game. I really could shoot the basketball, and you know, I felt very fortunate that I had an opportunity to play in an environment like Middletown, which it provided, because the Greater Miami Conference was very tough back then. A lot of big schools, a lot of really good players, but we had really turned the page of Middletown from my sophomore year to my junior year. And I was playing very well, even though the best player, the senior player, wasn't playing.
What do you remember about that time in terms of your own player development, thinking about how you went about improving your game? Talk a little bit about how much time you spent working on your game, both by yourself in a gym or on a court somewhere, and then how much time you spent playing pickup basketball.
Well, pickup basketball is huge in Middletown. See, at that time in the 70s in Middletown, on a summer, a Sunday in the summer, you would find the Miami of Ohio players, basketball players, the University of Dayton players, and all the University of Cincinnati players would play at Douglas Park. And it was a guy named Gypsy Joe would be on the microphone DJing the game. And they'd be 8, 9, 10 deep. And that's the kind of competitive environment I grew up in. You know, for me to go and play in a high school game was nothing. I played at University of Dayton. I played at Rice State. I played at University of Cincinnati against older guys. And when you play against older guys the way I grew up having to play, you know, I learned to count real quick. And I was trying to get every layup, every fast break. You know, I was going to be, I could score with both hands, which was unique in that time, but it allowed me more opportunity because I wasn't limited. I had to be on the right side of the floor. And a guy named Jesse Jemison, God bless his soul, got a scholarship from Middletown, the University of Cincinnati, took me out to Barnett's Park and showed me how to bank the basketball in. So, you know, my whole vision of what a basketball player should be is, you know, points in succession, you know, getting points, getting easy baskets, not making a hard play. And, you know, I'm 6'5", but I was never able to stand underneath the basket and jump up and just dunk it in. I could run and dunk it off one leg. I was always a one leg jumper. But I knew how to bank the basketball in. That lesson that Jesse gave me at Barnett's was really instrumental. You know, I run into a lot of kids that watch me play, and they always talk about I came to their gym. They never seen anyone bank the basketball in all the time. And I just got to be very good at it. That followed me through my career at Indiana University. In my career at Indiana, I shot 51% in my four-year career. I set a Big Ten record at the first guard to ever lead the Big Ten in field goal percentage. I shot 47% my senior year. I could just shoot the basketball, and I knew how to get out on fast break and get easy baskets. And if you're standing back there taking a charge, it's going to pull up and bank it off the window and go back down the court.
Why do you think the bank shot has, I don't know, I don't want to say disappeared because I don't know that it ever totally appeared in the game, but why do you think more players don't take advantage of it? You know, that's one of the things that when I'm coaching, especially younger kids, you try to talk to them about the value of using the backboard, and they don't always see that value. What do you attribute that to? Do you think
value
that it's,
is you don't have people that can teach it?
Yeah.
Right. You know, when you read about people talking about basketball analytics, they say shoot the three or get a layup. Well, every time you go for a layup, you bring the official and a potential for a charge. So, you know, what I teach is the closer you get to the basket, the lower your dribble is. And the reason is that anatomically, when you dribble the basketball up in your armpit, you're standing straight up. You're not very explosive. When I'm able to reduce their body height, make them more athletic, then it's easier for them to stop, pull up, and bank it off the window. It is a lost art, but there's a lot of lost arts right now because when you're telling kids to pull up from 20 feet or get a layup, that means the 18 feet in between you don't have to coach.
Yeah, I think that the shift in the game has been so interesting, and I want to jump back to something else that struck me as you were talking, just about, you know, you described the pickup basketball scene there in Middletown, and you think as you look around the country, and I think pickup basketball to a large degree, especially the way you described it, and I know that's the same way that I grew up playing, that scene of there being 8-9 teams deep of really, really good players, whether it's college players or adults or high school players, you just don't find that almost anywhere anymore. And to me, that's one of the things that I think has, I don't want to say completely hurt the game, because there's positives to today's youth basketball system, but I really think that for me as a player, and it sounds like you feel the same way, that your development as a player was so driven by that pickup basketball scene and the opportunity to play against players who were older than you, who were bigger than you, and that gave you the chance to develop your skills and develop your game. And so what's your thought process as far as the disappearance of playground basketball and maybe the effect that it's had on the game?
Well, the difference is directly correlated to AAU. When you played playground basketball and you play against older guys, you learned how to count. You couldn't just go out there and say, you know, hey, I'm working on my game. Well, you work on your game, we're not picking. Because if we lose, we're going to sit three games before we can get back.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I train coaches, and in my training, I tell them, you know, when a person talks about having a good recipe, and when you hear someone in the kitchen talking about they got a good recipe, normally we're talking about good ingredients in and good ingredients out. Well, that's, coaches don't think about this AAU boy or girl that comes to me, what are the bad things associated with it? The first thing is they're not forced to win games. They're going to play a game. The first question or second question they're going to ask, besides the first question may be where we're going to eat, the second question is going to be what time's our next game. So that competitiveness that was driven, and you combine that with, you know, the numerous scholarships that are in college today, 351 Division I schools. AAU delivers, they deliver kids who are non-competitive, and they deliver kids who cannot count. And you will, if you go to an AAU game, you will see numerous kids that were launched numerous shots, and they have no idea if they're 2 for 8 or 6 for 10. And so, you know, I try to explain to coaches that because the way the game of basketball is set up, half the games are lost in every conference. If you don't teach your players to count, you're not going to be able to get them into a style of play that will allow you to be successful. And so, you know, I graduated from the University School of Business. I graduated from high school basically at 16 years old. I had to take 3 classes to stay eligible for Ohio High School Athletic Association. I took classes at Miami University Middletown as a senior. But these kids can't count. And that's why I was always comfortable with coaching, because most coaches don't have the will to force them to learn how to count and put them in drills where there's a price to pay for not counting properly. And, you know, that's what's changed about basketball. You know, another place we would go play when I was in a pro and I lived in Centerville, we'd go play at an old high school called Dayton Roosevelt. And I'd go in the gym, there'd be Jim Paxson, John Paxson, Ron Harper, Frankie Sanders, and we would go at each other. And the other day I was on the phone talking to a guy, and he said, "Hey, Butch, I got Mark Baker here." And Mark was telling the kid how I grabbed him after one of the sessions at Roosevelt and taught him how to shoot a bank shot. and he said he never forgot that, because it became a big part of what he was doing when he went to Ohio State. And so, you know, it's the game has changed because the kids have not changed, but the process for them to be successful has changed. And defining success to them is getting a scholarship. It's not winning the conference championship or getting to the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the biggest downfall of the system today is that non-competitiveness, and you described it very, very, very well. We've talked about that on the podcast before, where, you know, the most important thing in a lot of cases with kids on the weekend, as you said, is when's lunch. And then, you know, regardless of what the result of the game is, they know they're playing again at, you know, if they played at noon, they know they're playing again at 2 p.m. and then they know they're playing again at 4 p.m. versus when you're growing up on the playground, you lose and you might never get back in.
That's correct.
You know, and I think that's something that the game is definitely missing. And there's some positives, like I said, to the system today. And I think that a lot more kids get exposed to basketball through the system today. But I just think that, again, as somebody who grew up in the system back with playground basketball, I still prefer that method for developing players and developing their competitiveness and developing their skills. And I think that it's something that we definitely miss out on today in today's game and the way that things are going with AAU. I'm just not sure that it's the best way to develop players. Now, that cat is probably already out of the box. I'm not sure how we stuff it back in. But I think that what you're trying to do and trying to educate coaches and get people to understand the concepts that you're trying to teach through analytics for coaching, for coaches, I think is something that people are going to want to hear more about as we dive further into this. Talk a little bit about how and why you made the decision to go to Indiana.
Well, I mean, the late, great Todd Bell and I both were from Middletown, and we visited Ohio State. And it was a football game, and they put us in the last row of the horseshoe. And I didn't like that.
That doesn't seem like a good sell job, Butch.
It didn't. I didn't come across to me as a good sell job. And, I was hesitant also because at the time, Fred Taylor, I wasn't sure, you know, from a coaching standpoint. Indiana had 5 guys that were graduating, mm-hmm. seniors, so there's going to be playing time. It was a basketball school. It wasn't a football school. All of Indiana games were on cable in Middletown. So I knew my family couldn't afford to be over there, but they could watch all the games on Channel 4. And so that, you know, that was pretty much, I originally wanted to go to Louisville, But during the Derby game, basketball game, Denny Crum signed Wade Houston and two of his star players, one of them being Derek Griffin, the other being Bobby. So at the end of the day, I said, well, there's going to be three of us trying to play the same position. But I had played a lot of summer basketball in Louisville because one of my uncles worked at the Ford plant in Louisville. So Bobby Turner and Daryl Griffin were two very good players. We all played the same position. And Indiana just seemed to be the right fit for me. When I went over there, those guys were blue jeans and army jackets. And I didn't have much, you know, and I just didn't feel – comfortable at Ohio State with Archie and them coming out with three-piece suits and briefcases, you know. So, you know, Woody asked me, was I tough enough to play at Ohio State? I guess he thought I was going to get mad, but I've never been one to lose my temper. And, you know, I basically can see through things. I knew what I wanted. I knew things, you know, would be good for me. He was graduating as players. Indiana School of Business at that time was in the top five in the country. It's just a good place for me to be.
And so obviously you go and play for Coach Knight. And so I think that anybody who has any knowledge of the game of basketball probably understands the toughness that was required from a mental and physical standpoint to play for Coach Knight. Can you share a story or two about your time with Coach Knight, something memorable that sticks out to you about your college career there at Indiana?
Well, it was always tough for me because I had a mom that was pretty tough on Coach Knight. And their deal was, you know, I couldn't come back home, you know, so he knew he could yell at me from day one and he knew I couldn't, there was no transferring. There wasn't no go back home. She said, if I set the example of the oldest coming back home, the rest of them would think they could come back home. So, you know, I think the most important story with him and I was, it was a conflict. I had been a pretty good student and then I got my car and I had a bad semester. And he took my keys for most of the summer school. But then when I got a 3.8 over the 10 hours in the summer school, then I really got in trouble. Because he said, yeah, I could have done it all the time, but he had to take the keys to my car because I was waxing it all the time. So, you know, Indiana's a unique place. I got more out of it than I ever could have anticipated. It's a special place to play basketball. It was the right decision for me. You know, I don't get back there. I live in Toronto. I don't get back there, but you know, for at that time in my life, it was the right place for me. The only bad thing that really happened to me at Indiana was I broke my fifth metatarsal on the first day of practice my freshman year. And that really set me back and took me a couple of years to get myself back.
Well, you think back to, again, the medical situation at that time, and you know, in a lot of cases, that particular injury, when you think about, you know, guys' feet who have played, you think of Bill Walton or I think of Sam Bowie, guys that have, you know, had injuries with their feet and had problems. And, you know, a lot of times they don't ever recover from that. So the fact that you were able to eventually bounce back, you know, is
that was a special because they didn't have to put a screw in it. And I healed on my own. But the immobility of the cast being on for so long, my Achilles was sore forever. And, it took a couple of years to get that worked out before I finally got back to being close to what I was, as a senior in high school.
So you get done at Indiana and you get drafted by the Lakers. Talk a little bit about your pro experience, share a story or two that kind of reflects what your experience was like in the NBA.
So I go to the Lakers and, Magic Johnson's greatest leader I've ever been around. He takes all the rookies out the night before we go to training camp. We go to training camp and I'm standing outside the gym and I'm really befuddled because at Indiana we didn't have plays. You have sets. You play motion. You play a more of a screening motion. You don't have a bunch of plays. You have sets, triangle, four inside. So Norm Nixon and I both had the same agent. And Norm said, what's wrong? And I said, I'm really worried about making the team because, you know, I've got to memorize 50 plays in 3 days for Pat Riley. And Norm took me to dinner, made me pay for dinner and buy all of his beer. and gave me a piece of paper and gave me five coins. He called out every play, and then I had me move all five coins to show him that I knew every position in the play. That was inspirational for me, because during the next 10 days in training camp, there were lots of guys that didn't know the damn plays, and I could step in, run their position, and show them that, you know, I was totally engaged. And I was fortunate enough to be drafted by the Lakers, go through these great practices and training camps with these great players. I learned a lot about coaching from being around those great players, because up until then, I was given the perception that great players were dumb. They were just athletic. Man, those guys, Magic Johnson, Jamal Wilkes, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, was smarter than any player, no matter what their talent was. But their basketball IQ and their human IQ was through the roof. So I learned a lot about how to handle great players. A large part of when I was in Toronto and drafted Vince Carter was based on, I basically felt that Vince Carter could play on that 1980 Laker team, that he had the skill set, the physicality to do it. I was very lucky to be with that team. I learned a lot about coaching. I learned a lot about preparation, how you can drive great players, being around Riles. He's a worker. He talks about, you know, you have to be locked in and committed. And a lot of that was just a lot of good stuff, man. For a young guy who wanted to go into coaching, going through that experience, seeing those great players, how they dealt with their body, how they handled things. It was just a lot of good stuff to see.
All right, so two questions there. One, at what point, as you were growing up through the game, at what point did you know that you wanted to coach? So that's the first question. And the second question is, you mentioned that, you know, you learned some things about how to deal with great players. So what did you learn specifically about how you can drive great players to achieve to their full potential? And then when did you know that you wanted to get into coaching? Were you still playing in high school? Was it when you got to the NBA? When did you realize you wanted to become a coach?
Well, when I went through the process of breaking my foot and not knowing, you know, when I was going to be able to play or how I was going to be able to play effectively in the Big Ten. So, you know, if you came to my house, you know, in my library, I've got every practice plan I've been in since I was 18 years old. So, you know, that's a lot of notes, a lot of good coaches. You know, at Indiana, there's two great things you learn as a coach. You learn to break the film down after the game, when you're harshest on yourself. The other one is you learn to change ends of the floor. You know, Knight was so far ahead of guys, because if you go to a practice today, they've practiced like 30 or 40 years ago. And at Indiana, we were never on one end of the court more than 4 minutes. We were never on one side of the floor more than 4 minutes. It builds what we call mental quickness. And by building mental quickness, you can take a player who's not as physically gifted and blend them in with guys who are physically gifted, because their minds are on the same page. They have the same form of training mental. So those were the two things, you know, that I learned that were big, and I knew that I wanted to coach. And my notes were always very helpful, because what you learn by keeping good notes is, a lot of times, you know, I've got a page and I've written the notes and then I've crossed through it. And that means, you know, this is stuff I've learned not to do. And
right,
a lot of coaches fail, young coaches fail, because they never get through the point of whatever you do, do not do this, because it's not going to get you to a winning record. As far as being around great players, what I learned is that you have to be totally prepared to go to practice and get your work in. And you don't stand around and talk them to death. You get precisely to what they want to do. And more importantly, if you can give them the video of their mistakes with the time code in it. And so now you're always talking to them factually, because they're not college players. They're grown men who make money. They have families. They have responsibilities. And there's a deep appreciation when you do not waste their time and get them organized so that they have a chance to be successful in the game.
Now, I think that by learning that and getting an opportunity to be with Hall of Fame players that early in your pro career certainly gave you a window. And then being around Pat Riley and just the level of winning that you were able to surround yourself with in that first year is just amazing. And I love that story that you told with Norm Nixon. And I think as I heard you say that, what I was thinking about is the number of players who are out there who don't take their craft seriously enough to put in the time to study and learn the game. And whether now it's watching film or just going back like you did and think about keeping those notes from every practice that you were in since you were age 18. And I would think that as you're talking to players, that story, to me, that just leapt through the microphone at me where, man, I can't believe that here's a guy who is already starting his pro career and now he's going to this level to make sure that he understands everything. And then conversely, as you said, you were stepping in for guys who didn't know all those plays and didn't know what their responsibilities were in every set that you guys were trying to run. And so a huge advantage for you in that your mind was quick enough to be able to pick that stuff up and understand it. And I think that that's a great lesson for players out there. And it's also a great lesson for coaches to try to impart to their players that, hey, if you know everything that's going on your team, if you know your offensive sets, you know your defensive sets, you know where you're supposed to be in this situation and that situation, it's such a huge advantage, A, for you as a player to advance in your career, but then just think about it as a coach. If you can get every player thinking on that same wavelength, the ability that you have then as a team to come together and have success, I think would have to be tremendous.
Well, it is tremendous and a tremendous advantage because once you learn the true math of basketball for coaches, it really boils down to you get back in transition, over-communicating, getting back in transition, and then scoring runs. But if you have two guys out of every seven or eight plays that are missing what their assignment is, you're never going to get on scoring runs. I've never seen a scoring run that did not directly affect the opposing coaches and it made the officials just leave you alone. You know, if you're out there and everybody's on the same page and you're executing and making shots, getting the shots you want, and all of a sudden you're up, you know, 9-1, 9-2, you know, then you go 4-4, then you come back and you hit them 6-1, you know, you're forcing a timeout. And when you're forcing timeouts, that means bad things are happening.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
Most guys get so emotionally tied. You know, I love the game and, you know, I want to be a part of it. And they make bad decisions for their families. And what I mean is that, you know, every conference, high school level, you know, I started out as a high school coach. All right, at Middletown, Ohio, I started out as a high school coach. But in 2 years, we went from not being very good to where I was named Ohio High School Coach of the Year. Because at the end of the day, I had been in my system with my books. I knew exactly what I needed to get into practice. And I needed to run a style of play that fit the players. And young coaches fail because they say, well, I want to play this way. This is the way I played. Well, that means you're going to practice the way you practice. And if you walk in most high school gyms, I guarantee you they're going to be on one end of the floor for 20 or 30 minutes or even longer. I was at a college and they were on one end of the floor for an hour and a half. And then they lose games because the kids can't get back in transition. So it goes back to, you know, what I started about that good recipe, good food in, good food out. But what the mistake coaches make is because they're so inexperienced, they don't give the practice content to the players the way it comes to them in the game. Transition is 25-28% of your possessions every game. It's the only thing in basketball you have to do on both ends of the floor. But guys want to get, they're so caught up in, you know, well, I want to run San Antonio or, you know, I want to run Chin. I mean, the issue at the end of the day is that the first thing you need to do to establish and take a team from being bad just to being reasonable is that they're not giving up a bunch of layups. Because once you give a bunch of layups, you encourage the crowd, you they get confidence. And the officials know a bad team from a good team. And so, you know, it's a matter of there are guys who can turn programs around because they don't waste time on things that are really unimportant to the result of the game.
All right, so how do you teach transition? What's the key? If I'm a high school coach and I hear you say that.
Over-communicate. We're going to do full court transition. We're going to put four. Well, first of all, every drill, everything we do in a progression drill. You don't just start 5-on-5. You start 3-on-3. All right. And you roll the ball and you, whoever you roll the ball, call the number. He has to touch the line and they're going to play man advantage until he can recover and get back in. Then you go 4-on-4. Then you go 5-on-5. All right. Every drill starts out as a part. You go part, part, whole. All right? Part, part, whole is a basic teaching concept that always totals 10. When you play basketball, there are going to be 10 people on the floor. So the word is not communicate, it's over-communicate. Why is it over-communicate? Because you're always going to get slippage. But if you tell them to communicate, when they slip, they're going to go to silent. So you tell them to over-communicate. And what does that mean, coach? That means, hey, I'm on your left. I'm on your right. I've got the ball stop. I've got the first pass. All right? And then that's defining for the guy who's coming back on the advantage, the defender that had to touch the line. All right? He's pointing to where he's going. So, and you build that up. 3-on-3, 4-on-4. This has to be a part of every practice that you do every day. That you are going to get back, get them covered, build your wall, and work out of your defense from your wall from there.
So let me ask you this: do you model the exact phrasing that you want players to use in that particular situation? So, in other words, when a player is getting back on defense and they're supposed to be communicating with their teammates, do you recommend teaching specific phrases players to use, or does that sort of happen organically? How do you do that?
So I can send you my high school our acronyms that we use. All right. So you want to teach them free throw line extended. You want to teach them how you want them to close out. All right. And think about it. If we're looking at a half court, and if you took your arms and made a triangle from the center line at half court to the corners. That was the area we wanted to keep you out of. So I would draw that triangle from center court, all right, to the corners. All right, guys, I hear guys say, well, you know, we don't want to give up baseline, we don't want to give up middle. No, dude. All right. That is wrong. You want to drive them to the corner. That means you're not giving up baseline, you're not giving up middle. All right. So your acronyms need to be, that's something high school coaches should teach in the summer. So the kids, when they come to the gym, they understand how to communicate with each other. You know, put their phones down. This is how we communicate and get clarity on it. Clarity is a very important thing in basketball and a marriage.
You're right about that, Butch. You got that one 100% right.
So I hear young coaches talking about, they got to figure it out. Like, that, you know, that how is that leadership? All right. So the adult should figure it out and relay it out. But if you have them over communicate, You have them with, you know, understand what your acronyms are all the way down through your program. You get a chance to get people stopped. And everybody's got to play road games. You know, that gives you a chance to go in the toughest places to play road games. The kids can communicate, make shots, go on scoring runs, get a W and get out of there.
One of the things that I see, and let me ask you how you combat this, because I know it's something that I've seen sometimes with teams that I've coached. I've been never been a high school coach at the head coaching level, but mm-hmm. Ben was an assistant for a long time. And, you know, I've coached various teams at other levels. And I think that one of the things that I find that I haven't been necessarily very good at is I'll put an emphasis on communication for a week, for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks. And then for whatever reason, I'll let that slip. And maybe we start out and we're communicating, to use your term. We're definitely not over communicating. And then, as you said, we tend to slip and put that, it sort of goes away. And I think that that's something that as a coach, one of the things that I find is, especially as we've done this podcast and I've talked to successful coaches at all different kinds of levels, the one word that always keeps coming back to me with coaches who are the most successful are the ones who are intentional every single day about the things that they do. And I think what I hear you saying here in terms of communication is you have to be intentional that this has to be a part of your practice. It has to be a demand and expectation that every single day we're going to communicate as a team. And if we don't, then that's where we're going to have problems.
Correct. Because you're going to run into good teams in hostile environments and they're not going to be able to hear each other. You know, you're not going to be able to coach them the way you want to because they can't hear you from the bench. And you have to train them to be independent contractors with their verbal communication. And you just don't do it when you're doing transition drills. You do it every time. If I'm passing the ball to my teammate and, you know, we're going two balls, three men, two balls up and down the floor, they're calling out the names. My high school kids from Middletown, they came to see me coach to Toronto at dinner. They were laughing. They said, Vince Carter is doing the same drills I did in high school. So like, yeah, he does the same drills, two ball dribbling, has to communicate, no dunking. They said, but that's Vince Carter. I said, yeah. So how do you think he learned to make a shot? So I put in a rule that $500 for any time any one of my young players, McGrady or Carter, would dunk in practice. And that was to teach him to play basketball and not be out on the playground trying to create a highlight film. And it worked very well. Both of them are going to be in the Hall of Fame. So, you know, I find coaches, because they're so inexperienced, they don't understand, like, what is the one thing I have to get done? I have to give them what are the 10 or 12 acronyms we're going to use. And I've got to have my will to force them to communicate has to be stronger than theirs. And it's not about yelling and screaming. I tell them all the time, like, no, look, you know, up and down. You know, you either talk with your mouth or talk with your feet. You know, I don't want to decide it, but, you know, I will if I have to. And they learn to talk with their mouth and keep me out of their business.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that, as you said, by making it an emphasis every single day, every single drill, I think that you're going to have more success. And I keep coming back to that word intentional. And I think if you put together, and we'll talk about this here in a second too, in terms of putting together a quality practice plan that really reflects the things that have an impact on winning and losing. I know that's one of the things that you really have sort of set your foundation on here with Analytics for Coaches, is that idea that you have to make sure that you have a plan and that that plan actually has an impact on winning and losing games. So why don't we kind of jump into that and talk a little bit about what the platform, why you created it, where it came from, and then get into how it can benefit a coach who's going to be taking part and purchase your program and get involved with you on this platform.
Okay, so the program was initialized back in 1997. In a NBA head coaches meeting in Chicago, David Stern told the head coaches that the NBA had been collecting all this data from the 20 cameras in every arena. And back then there were only 26 teams. And then in the fall of 97, there was a lockout. So once my kids went back to school, I headed out to Colorado Springs. And the man who was over the, in charge of managing the data, Mike Ellis, fortunately for me, he was a Canadian. And I was coached to rap. So after a couple of good meals and lots of beer, I actually flew him to Toronto. And we basically locked ourselves in a room. And Mike said, "Butch, I don't know anything about basketball." I said, "You don't have to. I'm going to tell you what direction." But Mike was a brilliant mathematician. So when they give you an expansion team that won 18 games, as a young coach, and you spent your whole life studying to be a coach, I spent a lot of time also on losing teams. I had some pretty defined values about what I wanted to try to get done. One, anything that has to do with personnel, I was always going to encourage the general manager that I wanted athletes that were long. I wanted guys that could defend two positions. I think there is huge value in when you're starting a program that you have interchangeable parts. Don't look at your lineup as a one, a two, a three, a four, a five. Look at your lineup as a basketball player, a basketball player, a basketball player, a basketball player, a basketball player. Now, some of those players may have limitations, but my goal is that if a team is better than me, if he's got a star player, then I'm going to have my combination is going to be better than his star player. So that's the way I've always been. That's how we got Middletown turned around as a high school coach so fast, was that everybody thought that, you know, we're going to play some fancy. No, I just got a bunch of rugrats from my old neighborhood to play. I got half the football team, Darren Clafter scholarship to Stanford. I think there were three football players that got football scholarships. Doug got a scholarship to Akron. So what we did was that with Mike, told Mike, I wanted to put every player in a model and I wanted their stats based on a per minute basis. Now, this is the fall of 1997. Right? And Mike was in Colorado Springs. And basically they asked, why do you want by a per minute? Because what I had found in my tenure as a player in the NBA and as an assistant coach with Milwaukee for 6 years and a scout, that the true character of a player is defined on what he does on a per minute basis. His true body energy, his core strength. And then what I said was anyone on a losing team, we delete them out of the model. I only wanted to see the positive integer. So when in the NBA, there's 1,230 games lost every year. There's 1,230 games won every year. So if we drew a T, to the right top of the T, we put 1,230. That's the positive integer of wins. And on the left side, 1,230 is the negative integer. So this is a common mistake that coaches make. Coaches don't understand that you need to be on the positive side of 1230 to get a new contract. They're so busy thinking, well, I got to get my stuff in. And while they're getting their stuff in and losing games, and we lost for 6 years in Milwaukee. We drafted the wrong people. Mike Dunleavy is a very good NBA coach, but it's with older teams. We had young guys. He had no experience. And Mike was not one to listen to what he should be doing because he had an 8-year contract. So when I came to Toronto, I wanted to get on the winning side of 1230 as fast as possible. At that time, within my first six players were Tracy McGrady, was a rookie, and Doug Christie. I had two of the eventual would be of my first eight players that set the NBA record for the most wins in the fastest amount of time. So once we put everybody in on a per minute basis, Toronto statistically was next to last and defensive rebounds. So what that means is that your defensive field goal percentage is high, which is not a good mark. And when they're missing those shots, you're not getting the rebounds. So then we said, okay, let's put the rebounders per minute on winning teams. There were four guys that we nailed that we said we wanted to get. One was Charles Oakley. The other one was Dale Davis. The other one was Antonio Davis and Kevin Willis. The reason that I wanted to target those guys, because every year in the NBA, when NBA teams lose in the playoffs, the general manager has to find someone to blame. And he's going to move a player that you'd not normally be able to get. So we traded Marcus Camby for Charles Oakley. Indiana, we traded Jonathan Bender for Antonio. They wouldn't give us Dale. And Kevin Willis, we gave Houston a second round pick. So with those three and the drafting of Vince Carter, I've got six of my starting eight. We signed Dell Curry because statistically, Dell Curry was the best open shooter in the NBA. And in my mind, I wanted to move Tracy to the backup point guard. And in doing that, I would need at least one shooter. We acquired D. Brown. But it was all driven off of half of the games are lost. Every high school, if there's 100 total games played in a conference, 50 of them are going to be ones, 51 are going to be losses. If you cut the 50s in quarters, you'll have 25, which would be the two best teams, then 25, and then they'd be on the negative integer on 25 and 25. This happens every year, every season, and coaches go into it and if they don't understand the empirical number of your conference, then you're always putting your family at jeopardy because you're not going to be able to provide them long-term security. And so once we recognized this and we built this model out, so empirical, when you talk about the numbers that the coaches need, this isn't the numbers that they to run the front office, because the people who run the front office in the NBA, they are still what I call plugging their formulas with the numbers from the losing teams. The numbers from the losing teams are irrelevant to a coaching staff because if you're in those numbers, they're going to shoot you. So once you understand the empirical number, the second most into the empirical formula, all right, are what are the four things you have to do? You have to over-communicate and transition. 1230 is the empirical number of losses in the NBA. In the NBA, over the last 5 years, when I created this stat in 97, if you won the first and third quarter, you won 67% of your games. The reason I was doing the research on it was that I was trying to figure out why is Utah winning all these games in the West? And I knew they had Stockton and Malone. But they were dominating the Western Conference because they dominated the first and third quarter. Over the last 20 years, that first and third quarter stat has been dominated by Utah, then was handed off to San Antonio, then it was handed off to Golden State. But what it really showed was that you would win majority of your games, and the officials seemed to stay out of the game. So I've got three things. 1230 is empirical. I got to get back and communicate and get stops in transition. Win the first and third quarter. And the fourth one are scoring runs. So I knew this. I'm out of basketball. I'm in business. I'm doing some other stuff. And 5 years ago, Rory Sparrow, who's over NBA player development, calls me and says, Coach, I need you to get off your couch. And come help me with this program to train former players who want to go into coaching. And at that time, the program was predominantly based on former players wanting to go into coaching and basically doing player development. And I convinced the NBA office that through Rory Sparrow and his boss that we need to change the program. In the last 3 years, we trained them on what we call analytics for coaches. We train them on all the basketball software, Synergy, Fast Scout, Fast Draw, Sports Code, and I train them on specific modules, like timeout solutions, substitution synergy, all the things that are on the hierarchy of what a coach, if I wanted to take a class of 20 guys who just want to start to coach, this is the way I would train them. You need to know that half the games are lost. So you can sit around a cup of coffee and talk all you want, but the concepts that you come up with have to fit into the upper half of your empirical number. So I told Rory I hadn't run my numbers in, 18 years. And so he put me in touch with the guy head of NBA analytics. And over the last 5 years, if you won the first and third quarter, you won 84% of your games. And if you win the first and third quarter in the NBA playoffs the last 5 years, you win 88% of your game. So if you go back and think, the Toronto Raptors victory over Golden State, everyone thinks it was based on the energy. No, it was based off of the fact that the Toronto Raptors were the one team that dominated the first and third quarter against Golden State. So, then what we've done is asked the NBA, can we roll out a platform for more candidates for a longer period of time? I think we're going to get that deal done here in the next 10 days or so. And that means that we would start taking candidates in October. They would go through online training through a platform that we have called Just Play that we partnered with. And they would finish that platform 8 months later. It would be, I think, world class as far as a teaching tool. It teaches people that regardless of what your situation is, here's what you have to get to. It teaches them how to do it. It's pretty simple. It's online training. There are tests within the online training so that they can actually see. Let me give you a simple one, that mistake we've always got to clean up. For whatever reason, Digger Phelps is the one that brought the coaching huddle to timeout. Before Digger Phelps, the older coaches, everybody went right to and talked to the kids. Now, every coach and that does your podcast or is listening, during a timeout, they all got to stand out almost by the free throw line like they're interviewing for a new job. Right? In a high school game, and I just did this presentation at the Ohio High School Coaches Clinic, there are going to be 14 what I call blind spots. You got four starts of four quarters. A blind spot is where the two opposing coaches that are going to be telling their kids what you're running they will not know what you're running. And then you have the coaches have five timeouts apiece. So that could be up to 14 blind spots. So what I did as coach of the Raptors is that I took the timeout scenario where we could have up to 18 in the NBA. And I weaponized it. A timeout has a first side, which is the team that has the ball, and a second side. And by the end of my second year, the last 40-something games, we were 17 points better than our opponents every game because we had weaponized the first side of the timeout where we came out and executed. We didn't execute just one play. We called what we had first play, second play. And on the second side, we were always busting up what the opponent wanted to do. So in college basketball last year, no one was better than Rick Barnes at that. Rick was going to run a three-quarter soft 2-2-1 trap, burnt to have you be able to burn the clock when you bring it across the timeline. And then on the first side, he was going to go right to his All-American power forward on scoring opportunities. So, I see a lot of coaches that do it correctly. There's a ton of coaches that do it bad.
The Head Start Basketball Holiday Camp for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 will be held on December 26th and 27th. Join us for two fun days of basketball fundamentals, contests, and small-sided games. You can find more information or get registered at headstartbasketball.com.
So at Ohio High School Coaching Clinic, I actually had the head coach at Portsmouth Boys. I actually on his phone had him call off 45 seconds, every 45 seconds. And what I was trying to show these guys is that you are burning all this time. And why is a coach who's behind by 10 points spending all this time on the floor with his coaches when if he doesn't catch up on the 10 points, all right, he can't win the game? But this thing is so conditioned in these coaches that they forget the concept of, if I'm behind, I got to work a little harder and work a little more. I got to be better organized. So Analytics for Coaches is a rollout. We first went to the Final Four last year in Minneapolis and kind of did a soft rollout. We use it as a teaching tool on both men's and women's side. The tools are factually accurate. Most coaches don't know what the empirical number is. Most coaches don't know that you're not supposed to be standing out there talking to someone when you're down 8 points in a timeout. So it's just a very concise, more practical way of approaching a game to winning. And to me, it's showing coaches how to extend their careers and have a career in coaching. It's also a very good tool on interviews because now we can define, you tell us what the job is, we can define what the conference empirical number is, and we can define why the teams have won in the last, you know, I've gone back as far as I did one for the former Nebraska coach. We went back 7 years that he was Nebraska, and Tim Miles was so impressed. He's like, man, I was way behind, like, you know, you just don't realize it because no one's ever told you. And I think hopefully Tim will be back and Analytics for Coaches will be part of what he's doing going in the future. But it's definitely defining your weaknesses as a coach. It is a true evaluation of if you're doing a good job in an area in which most coaches do a horrible job.
So if we're thinking about this in terms of, if I'm a high school coach or I'm a former NBA player who wants to get into coaching, does the program, is it adjusted based on the level of the coach who's going through the program, or how do you guys have that tiered, or how does that work?
Everything starts like I'm teaching a high school coach.
Okay.
Right. It's, you know, the first thing is we have to teach you simple things like, okay, time out, right? And just stay with me. The basketball court runs east-west. Most coaches are standing in timeout with the board going north-south, drawing up a play. I mean, how many times you watch kids standing trying to look at the play and turn their head sideways? So it teaches you, you know, when the timeout's called, and I'll give you a couple keys. Timeout's called, I got to know where the ball's being taken out and if I need to sub. Those have to be cleared up the first 5 seconds of the timeout. I was at the Illinois at Indiana game last year. There were 18 timeouts, and three times someone was running to the scorer's table as they broke out of timeout.
I've seen that a lot.
Right? The issue is that the timeout for in a game used properly by a coaching staff is a tremendous weapon. Because it does two things. It hurts those opposing coaches and it impresses those officials. Everybody forgets officials don't have home games. They've seen more games in more places than anybody. And it's what Jess Kersey, an old NBA official, told me. He said, Butch, we know a bad team right away, man. They come out of timeout and call the play out. Right? So, again, you know, how many times, you know, guy, he wastes the time out, he's out there talking, then he sits down and he's just taking a marker and he's stabbing his court board. He's not drawing anything. And he's going to come out and run a regular play, and he's got a veteran coach and a staff sitting down there and say, okay, we got that one. So when I was coaching, when I took over the Raptors, I was coaching against 10 Hall of Fame coaches. 10. And that didn't count Dunleavy in Portland, had the best record in the West. Flip Saunders was in Minnesota. Van Gundy was in New York, but it was a beast. Patino was in Boston. Lenny Wilkins was in Atlanta. Riley was in Miami. Texas was a monster. Popovich was in San Antonio. Don Nelson was in Dallas. Rudy T was in Houston. Phil Jackson was in L.A. I'm missing a couple, but I'll find them. but it was, you know, I was scared. I was a young coach. I wanted to win. And the only way for me to win was get ahead of them. So, you know, and we started the season in January of 98. I mean, you know, we were very dynamic. We had changed what we looked like physically. We had the ability to switch and force you to have to play against someone that was very athletic. We were very good in transition. I had acquired three guys that had gone deep in the playoffs and in the veteran bigs. And it just, for me, it's always about, like, you know, I don't want to sit around with five guys and they're going to say, I think. Like, you know, my life, I don't know how much time I got left on the clock, but I don't want to be sitting around thinking about stuff. This is proven stuff at the highest level. It works. And it's good for any coach that wants to have a career. If he really wants to have a career and move up, go in. Like, we take our candidates. Our candidates now can go in and interview. They can do all of the video work. They can do the on-the-court work. And in their mind, they're there to help the coach understand what we're talking about. Like, you know, we don't want to be doing things that are going to have us in that lower half of the losing side.
So how much of, if we think about, I'm just thinking about the timeout situation just as an example. Mm-hmm. So how much of it is, in your mind, a balance between spending time and, again, being intentional within your practice setting to practice those timeout situations where, again, a lot of coaches have, you know, the whatever, they got their out-of-bounds play underneath, they got a couple sideline plays, but how much time do they really spend going through and, yeah, maybe they teach it and the kids know where they're supposed to go, but yeah. Do they really put in the time to make the details so that each player knows exactly what, why, how they're doing, and then combine that with the ability to, I don't know, perform under pressure is maybe the wrong way to say it, but to be able to then, as a coach, execute the ability to tell your players, here's what we're going to do, here's why we're doing it, here's the situation. So how important is the balance between those two things? Because I think the synergy between putting it in practice and making sure you spend the proper amount of time on that during your practice setting, then combined with the ability to make good, quick decisions under pressure as a coach in a timeout situation, it seems like the balance between those two is where you're really going to end up having success.
Well, yeah. So the first thing we really have to, we tell them, like, look, if we can't get in your practice plan, there's no need in signing up for the module. And, you know, I strongly suggest, like, what I used to do is I would, all my warmups would be all of my side out of bounds, baseline out of bounds, home run. There's a play that a set that we had called rush, and that meant we were behind and we didn't have any timeouts. We wanted to save them. So we could go off of a make or miss free throw and go right into, I could tell them we were on rush for two or rush for three. And it's just a very good play. I got it from Larry Brown. We were very, very successful with it in coming from behind. But straight to your point, if a coach isn't willing to open up his practice plan, then you're not going to be able to weaponize the timeouts. Because the reason I needed to do it was that NBA officials, no one seen more games than NBA officials. I was coaching against those 10 Hall of Fame, and I needed every advantage I could get. And because we used it every day in practice, every single day in warm-ups. See, when I put something, when I have what I call a coaching block, so I'll have five coaching blocks. It'll be transition. It could be shell drill. We want to do our offense. So I'll take those five or six blocks, and then if you think of shuffling cards, I'll shuffle 4-minute segments of those blocks into my practice plan. So we'll go from transition to shell drill to two ball shooting. And My practices are very active, where we're on both ends of the floor, we're moving around, they're over communicating, and we're going to have six times where we're going to go over out of bounds plays. And this is what you have to understand and what we do forget. We don't tell you, you don't have to have 25 plays. You need to have three sets. And in those three sets, you can get the three options. So it's what I call bait and switch. So everybody has side out of bounds box. Bigs on top, point guard on the ball side, shooting guard on the opposite side. But what the mistake a lot of coaches make is that to change box, all you have to do is move the box up. Because if you move the box up, you can have one back pick for your big, and X1 has to bump or you're going to get a layup. So what we do is say, okay, we're more experienced at this. We're just going to give you general concepts. And 2 weeks ago, I was down at James Madison Women. And after practice, me and coach just went through and I said, okay, here's your baseline play. All right. Here's your two concepts. And here's two concepts I've come in just watching. So I don't try to give them, you know, we're going to be fancy and run 25 new NBA plays. I try to say, let's take what you have. And just conceptually, you can always get another option just by moving your set up level or above the ball. And coaches don't understand this. So we have a huge library. Right now on Just Play, I've got the last 3 years, every head coach in the NBA in the last 3 years, every end of game play they have. So we don't start you there. We get you started on the main concept of you got 60 seconds. You need to know where the ball is being taken out at. You need to know if you need a sub. Your board needs to run east to west so that your players can see the play just like it's going to be run on the court. And then at the end of that, you've got to tell them, okay, what are we in if we make or miss? So we start at the basic fundamentals. They got to get 80% on their test for them to go forward. There's a chat where they can chat directly with me as they go through it. But the opener, like all things for coaching staff, is modify your practice plan. And you're going to run side out of bounds or baseline out of bounds or have these blind spots 14 times a game, at least in high school. And what play are you going to run 14 times? So coaches spend time on running a play that they're going to run five or six times, and they don't work on the fact that these timeouts are not going away. It's worse in college because of they're forced on colleges because of the TV, right?
Yep.
So, you know, Mike and Jason, I just think it's really, man, it's a freebie. It is a freebie, and I used to murder them on it. And, you know, we'd run a regular set. Oh, here, you know, they're running. Watch the lob for Vince. I just have Vince back pick for somebody, and, you know, they're scared to death. The guy on Vince, they're going to come off of him. That'd be the first play. So we'd always have two plays. You know, the second play would be easy. You know, now I could have Vince back pick, and they've worked it out what they're going to do, and then Vince just peel off for a lot. So I'm a big counterpuncher. I believe you have to counterpunch. And on the second side, you know, I may go 1-3-1. I may go 1-3-1 half court just to have you burn clock and try to figure out, because most NBA coaches have never been in college. They have no idea on zone offense. Right? I mean, look at it.
No, it's true. I hear you.
Yeah, Nick Nurse went boxing one, and Steve Kerr and his whole staff didn't know what to do. Right? And that's for the NBA championship. You want to talk about timeout solutions? Go to the final play of the NCAA championship game. All right? Texas Tech calls timeout. They're on the second side of the timeout. They're on defense. Virginia comes in. All Texas Tech had to do was foul. Virginia drives. Tech does their normal defense. They shrink. He kicks it out to the three-point shooter. Tie the game. The guy had the trophy in Lubbock, and he gave it back to Virginia. First side, second side. It's been there every game forever. And coaches get so consumed, I'm going to go to clinic, you know. Oh, I got this great play. There's no greater play than being better good in timeout. So I think I've said enough on that, Mike.
No, I agree with you. It's funny because I'll give you an example. I'm going to go to the complete opposite level of what you talked about.
Yeah.
So right now I'm coaching my daughter's fourth grade travel basketball team.
Yep.
And the number of times that the ball goes out of bounds and we have to take it out underneath and try to score a basket with fourth grade girls and against fourth grade girls. And if you can execute an out of bounds play, you can score almost every time, because obviously if you can set a good screen and get somebody to move, and you can score. And conversely, if you can stop the other team, and like, I'll position my girl who's guarding the person who's taken out of bounds underneath the basket, because obviously where most teams trying to score on the opposite block from where the ball's taken out. Right. And so, like, as you're talking about these things and you're talking about them at the highest level, I'm thinking in my mind with the level where I'm coaching at now, and how much, if I could win those out of bounds plays, those timeout situations like you described, how much easier it would be for my team to win those games. And I can just, again, I could see it at every single level of basketball, how valuable it can be. And I can also see, as you've said numerous times, that coaches just overlook that because they're focused on, again, they want to run their offense, or they have this system, or they want to work on this press, or they want to do that, this or that. And you forget that those out of bounds plays, those simple situations, those things that are, again, seem like they would be common sense, but that we forget about as coaches. And if we focus on what really helps us to win, I think that's what you're trying to get across to people, is look at what actually impacts winning as opposed to your system or what you think works, and instead focus on what does. So why don't you go ahead, Butch, and give people the contact information for yourself. Let them know what your website is, how they can get in touch with you. To coaches out there, I think if you've listened to Butch talk tonight, you can see what the value is in what he's put together with Analytics for Coaches. I hope a bunch of you will reach out to him and get involved with this, because I think there's a tremendous amount of value. So Butch, go ahead and share how people can find out more about it, how they can get in contact with you, and then we'll jump back and wrap up the episode.
Well, our website is analyticsforcoaches.com. We also can be found on social media, Twitter and Instagram, Analytics for Coaches. You can reach me at butchcarter@rogers.com. And we're more than happy to do a webinar for the coaches and their coaching staff. And when for the high school coaches, we allow up to 3 coaches on the staff to have access to the module. And the goal for me is that it becomes a weapon for the coaches. It is, it's something that, to be quite honest with you, it helped me make a lot of money, because we got so good at it. The great part about it was that once the players understood how successful we could be at it, the more they actually asked of me. Because it's the one time in a game that when you're coaching against a really good coaching staff, they should have no idea what you're going to do to them. And that makes them uncomfortable. And you know, good teams don't like being uncomfortable. So analyticsforcoaches.com. I really appreciate the time, Mike and Jason. It's been awesome. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure to be able to talk to you and dive deep into what makes for successful and winning basketball. And I think that what we're trying to do with the podcast here, and I think you're trying to do the same thing in a different way, is to be able to help the game of basketball improve and get better. And I think really that's what it's all about. And so when we get an opportunity to talk to someone like you, who has such a just diverse and tremendous background in the game at all levels, from, you know, being you know, an all-state Mr. Basketball in Ohio, going all the way through to your professional career as a player and as a coach, the opportunity to talk to you and pick your brain and then have you share the great things that you've been able to do with Analytics for Coaches, I think is just, again, it's our pleasure to be able to have you on, and we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us. And like I said, I hope that our audience of coaches out there who are listening, please reach out to Butch, find out more about what he's doing. And I think that you will be very, very happy when you reach out and pick his brain and get involved with what he's trying to do, because I think it's going to help you to win more games. It's going to help you to have more success. And as he said numerous times, it's going to help you to have a long career in coaching and be successful and be happy and win more games, which is what we're all, you know, which is what we're all trying to do as we go out there and, you know, have an impact on our kids and the teams that we're coaches. So, Butch, thank you. We're really, really fortunate that we were able to have you on, and we would love to do it again at some point and continue to talk to you and stay in touch. And I know we will. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.